later did that either, because when they were in power for so long, in cities, especially city governments, and they were very corrupt, you know, the Tammany Hall corruption and all that before and back then, and but continued into like Chicago politics and all that. They also didn't want to get punished as an entire party. They didn't want the Republicans to get a leg into some urban areas that have been Democrat for decades, you know, even a century. So the nonpartisan thing works well for both parties. They like it. And they rather would have, also ideologically, they'd rather have people focus on the individual candidate rather than what the party stands for.
Or the issues.
Or the issues, right. And also it goes deeper, I think. They'd rather have people focus on the individual candidate than on the system. It's just a bad apple here and there. If you get rid of the corrupt politician, you get the good one in. Yeah.
It's a bamboozle. Yeah. It's a cloak over our heads.
Yeah. You get rid of the bad guy, you get the good guy in. You get rid of the man, you get the
bad
woman.
Bad cop, good cop.
Yeah. And now it breaks down on identity politics and stuff. You know, just put in Maggie Thatcher and things will be great for women internationally. Or
not
just
great for your kids because he's taking your milk.
Or put in Obama. Put in Obama, who, if you're about to read, Obama is a serious thinker. He put out a book. Read his book. You know, he likes Reagan. He said he liked Reagan. But no, you put Obama in and it's going to be great for black people. Well, it wasn't, was it? It wasn't great. Now, I understand the symbolic victory of having, an African-American president and all that. That is extremely important. But we could have done that with a better candidate, you know, and not through the Democratic Party. But that's another discussion. Or the Republicans, obviously. So anyway, nonpartisan. If this guy had done his homework, what we did in Seattle was we sued the city, because we had to let them put Socialist Alternative next to Sharma's name. So we're not nonpartisan. We are very partisan. We want people to know they're voting for socialist. We don't want to fool people. We don't want to, you know, have them think that we're something we're not. The Democrats love that. In fact, a handful of Democrats recently have been elected that only after the election do they say, oh, I'm a member of Democratic Socialist America, DSA, which is a group I don't support in many ways. It's good that a lot of people are interested in DSA, but DSA supports the Democratic Party or certain progressive, they call Democratic Party politicians. But one of the things they've been doing that's irritated the heck out of me is they have been running candidates that don't really stress or even mention their DSA affiliation until after the election. Then they say, oh, I'm a socialist and I got elected. No, you're not. Look, you didn't say you were a socialist. You didn't stress. You didn't run on that. And I looked at your campaign, by the way.
Same with Sanders. He didn't run on that, really.
Sanders is, well, let's put Sanders aside for 1 second. But then, you're basically right, but it's different. But anyway, what I'm saying about the DSA candidates, they run as Democrats. And you look at their programs, and they're even worse than some of the Democrat programs, you know? Like, I've seen some really so-called DSA people get elected with programs that are just liberal mush, like eclectic garbage about stuff like, you know, it's just so non-concrete. They don't say we're for 15 and this and that, you know, the ones I researched.
Yeah, no.
They get elected, then they say they were elected as socialists, and nobody knows that. How's that going to go down in the war? Well, what's going to happen is they're going to continue to bury that. They only said they were socialists for some left-wing magazine or something, or some left-wing news site. And then they're going to go back to hiding it because they didn't run on it. If you don't run on it, if you're not open about it, then you can't all of a sudden spring it on people. You know what I mean? Sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I forgot my
thought. Okay, I'm sorry. I had to finish that thought, or I thought I did. But the thing is, you mentioned something. What did you say? You said about before that.
Sanders.
Yeah, okay, so Sanders. Yes and no. Okay, here's the thing with Sanders. That, you know, we've talked about this before. I followed Sanders' campaign since the 70s, man. His political efforts since the 70s. And he was kind of a socialist in the 70s. In the 80s, he pretty much dropped that, starting really around the mid-80s, really. He supported Mondale in 84, you know. I maintain, it's my personal opinion, but you cannot support any Democratic Party politician and be a socialist. Now, you could in the past if you want to say, okay, I supported a Democratic Party politician, and now I am a socialist, and I'm not going to support them. That's fine. Everyone evolves, or a lot of people evolve, and so on. But I'm saying, like, you can't simultaneously say I am a socialist, and I'm voting Democratic Party, because it's a corporate political party with candidates that they're first and foremost put forward U.S. imperialist interests and capitalist interests. So Sanders comes about, and he is known as a socialist. But what happened with Sanders is he didn't promote that. People labeled him that in the media. And when he started, he had his head down and thought, I'm going to get red baited. Uh-oh. And what happened was this amazing thing, which is objectively good. He got called socialist and nobody batted an eye. They couldn't use the socialism against him. Democrats tried. So didn't I think Clinton or somebody
said... Is that because of the new polls that were favor
more
now?
More interest in socialism.
The new millennials are more in favor of as opposed to against.
That's a big part of it.
This is not the Cold War. We're coming out. Oh, well, all Soviet Union's gone. That's the end of history. Yep. And that's it. We can move on with our little peachy, you know, capitalist life, you know, bourgeoisie type, you know.
No, that's all. Both of those things are really a big part of that. And it just didn't have any effect. So what I saw was corporate media people labeling Sanders a socialist, riffing on that for a second. Sanders not really taking the bait most of the time. There was one time in the campaign where he did a low-key, this is what I think socialism is, and it was horrible. He was basically saying people like Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, and others, basically Democrats were socialists. Scandinavia socialists.
Lyndon Johnson, the guy who bombed Vietnam?
Yeah.
Okay.
Scandinavia socialist. I mean, he got it completely wrong on purpose, right? And, you know, I say this in full disclosure, Socialist Alternative ended up basically supporting his campaign after being critical of it and saying that, you know, because you're the Democrats, we don't support you. But then towards the end, Socialist Alternative officially supported his campaign. I disagreed with that, but that's where we ended up with that. But what I'm talking about now is this one part of that where was Sanders ever, like, running openly as a socialist? I maintain no, because he always waited for the other person to bring it up. And when he talked about socialism, he redefined it as liberalism, right? And meanwhile, this guy's got a voting record, by the way. He votes. Well, he votes for imperialism a lot of the time.
I remember him saying socialism is capitalism with a conscience.
Yeah, well, it's not. There's capitalism can't have a conscience. That's the problem.
That's what I was like, no, you lost me, sir.
Yeah. It's like, So Sanders, you know, does his thing, and I don't know, he's a little different than DSAers because he didn't deny the socialist thing. Well, I don't know, you're right, because he also didn't promote it. He got more attention though as a so-called socialist than the DSAers. I just feel it's a little different, but I'm not sure. I'm not saying it's better.
Scenario, Jeff, had it been Sanders versus Trump, where would we be today?
Okay, hold on 1 second. I got to give a station ID. This is WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford. Okay, so that's a very interesting thing. Now, a lot of people are putting out on the Facebook and so on the internet, Sanders would have won. Boom. Now, here's what I think. I think that the crap that Sanders went through within the DNC to make sure that Hillary got the thing would have been a Tea Party, no pun intended, to the real Tea Party, whatever that is, compared to what they would have done if he had been in that last, you know what I mean? He gets the nomination and he's running against Trump or whoever, let's say Trump. I think you would have seen the bourgeois loving Trump a lot more than they do now. In other words, there's parts of the ruling class that doesn't like Trump. And they make it known through the corporate media, whatever. There's a lot of anti-Trump stuff out there. Then there's a bunch of them that like Trump a lot. I mean, look what he's doing for them with the tax thing, right? So, but put yourself in a heated election campaign right before. I mean, how many months was it before between the Democratic Party nomination? It was July, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have November. So you have four months, about August, September, October. You have 4 months of campaigning, 4 or 5 months. I think we would have seen all stops out to stop Sanders from getting in. You would have the pissed off Hillary people. You would have had the corporate media people that really didn't trust him. Now, the countervailing argument to that is Sanders has been in the Senate and then before that the House for so long that he's kind of been vetted by the ruling class and they would tolerate this so-called socialist in power. But what was happening, but the counter argument to that would be, but what could he unleash? Inadvertently, unconsciously, he might unleash people that have a lot of illusions in real socialism or fake socialism like him or just in progressive things that he was talking about because he did talk about some good issues, right? That would make them double down against him. So in other words, some people that could tolerate him in the Senate would not be able to tolerate him in the president. I'm talking about presidency. I'm talking about rich, powerful, corporate people. So I think there would have been such a vicious campaign against Sanders, including trying to resurrect red baiting, whether that would work or not, I doubt it would, that they would have gotten people in a frenzy against him, and he would have lost, actually, to Trump. Because this is called, I think, dialectical materialist thinking. In other words, I'm looking at a process here,
yeah.
not as oh, one poll had Sanders at X amount, and one poll had Trump at X amount, and Sanders would have won more. That's a false way of looking at it. It would have been a total different paradigm, totally different process going on.
So this thing where people were saying, oh, Sanders, there's no way that he can win. All of a sudden, he won.
Who's he? Trump?
Trump.
Yes, it would have been the same thing all over again. Actually, I think that would have been different too. I think it would have been like, it would have been so obvious that Sanders was being vilified and isolated and attacked. Maybe they would have found some dirt on him or something. You know, there's all sorts of ways.
The towel,
yeah, so there's all sorts of ways to go after him. That Trump would not have seemed so extreme. And Trump himself, despite his the mythology about him as being a complete not responsible, not beholding to his advisors, you know, sort of a loose cannon type, I don't agree with that. I think there are times where they yank his chain, and they say, you got to do this, man. I don't care what you think. You got to do this. And he doesn't. So I think he would have been a different candidate with Sanders running. He would have been less flamboyant, less strange, and he would have been had so much money pouring in. Oh my God! I mean, you know, he could have recrafted himself, you know, in different ways. It's a great question, but I don't ever see it answered the way I'm answering it. I'm sure some people have done some thinking, mm-hmm. but the idea that the superficial ideas you see on Facebook and so on about how, like, oh yeah, Sanders more popular than Trump, Sanders wins. Since when did the most popular win? You know, even Clinton got the popular vote and didn't end up in the presidency. It's not the most popular in bourgeois electoral politics. You got the Supreme Court there ready to stomp on someone and say they're illegal for some reason. You know, you got the unelected Supreme Court ready to come down and just stomp on anything that they think goes beyond the pale. You have, it depends on what kind of movement also Sanders was able to generate. The counter argument to what I'm talking about is, what if Sanders had generated a big grassroots movement around his candidacy for president? Then, yeah, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that would have transcended the factor of everyone lining up against Sanders in the bourgeois, in the power elite, swallowing their discomfort around Trump to keep Sanders out. Then if there was a big enough mass movement to overcome that, maybe Sanders could have won. I'm not ruling it out. I'm just saying it's not likely. Because they would have tried to demonize that movement really, really hard. And again, it might not have been through red baiting, but through other means, you know? And you would have had, for example, the pissed off Clinton people and the pissed off right wing, I would just say DNC in general, right or liberal, they would have not just sat it out. They would have actually tried to sabotage it, I think. So they would try to get unions, for example, not to put people or money into campaigning for Sanders, that sort of thing. Like, the number of unions that ended up supporting Sanders was significant but small still. So I question, and also Sanders' own track record of, I believe, he'll say the right thing. He'll say, doesn't matter about me, you need to have a mass movement. I'm paraphrasing, but he says things equivalent to this. You need to have a mass movement to get X, Y, or Z. But it's very... it doesn't look like to me that he's ever used political office to build a mass movement. You know what I mean? So I don't think he would be taking... I think he would be taking that presidential election in a more traditional sense and traditional direction than someone that would use it like we would as a platform to organize from in a mass way. But if say that he somehow did... use that campaign to build a movement, then maybe he would have won. But again, why doesn't Sanders build movements? Because they can get out of control. You know, like a movement around Sanders could have easily become a movement for a third party rather than just elected as a Democrat before or even before the election, you know? And he wouldn't want that. He didn't want that, you know? Doesn't want it. He wants to try to reform the Democratic Party, which is a huge, huge error. Often repeated in American politics by so-called progressives and the so-called left or the left. So anyway, that's a great question, but I don't think that there's an automatic answer. Speaking of questions. Here's some bad. This is a really weird way of looking at things. We're back to this National Review article. National Review, a conservative magazine attacking socialist alternative. The author, Philip DeVoe, who needs to even just like take a college course on socialism, much less a real exploration of it. He says that Sawant's fellow socialist alternative members... So we talked about nonpartisan. She declared her affiliation with the Trotskyite. Trotskyite's always the slur version of Trotskyist or whatever. The Trotskyite Socialist Party during her first campaign back in 2015. It was actually 2013, I believe. So that's wrong. In her inauguration speech, she reminded Seattleites that she wears the pledge of socialists, the badge of socialists with pride. That's pretty close to true. He screwed up the quote a little bit, I think. So once fellow social alternative members, in turn, why should you believe the social revolution is coming? Now, do we believe a social revolution is coming, social alternative? Yes and no. We think the conditions are there under capitalism, that there will be attempts to revolt against capitalism. There will be organizing towards that end. There'll be rebellions. But whether it gets to the point of a revolution, we put that as an open question. Whether it's successful, we put it as another question. So I don't go around organizing people in the socialist alternative by saying, we're going to have a revolution in 5 years. Definitely. We're definitely going to have socialism in the future. Say, here's what capitalism is doing. Here's how it's been fought against in the past. Good chance there'll be movements, mass movements, rebellions, revolutions. Mm-hmm. Will they be successful? That depends a little bit on what we do, but depends on a lot of factors. But I hope so.
To be involved in that process.
Right. And I also say I hope so because the way capitalism is going is destroying the planet in terms of human habitation. And who knows when a nuclear war might pop. So I'm not, I will say there's a serious, very, very serious side to building socialism. It's really only the hope for humanity, in my opinion. But on the other hand, for a future, a decent future especially. But on the other hand, I'm sorry. There's no guarantee it's going to happen. That's up to human beings, you know.
Again, the dialectic materialism. It's up to the history.
Process at work.
We'll
see.
I mean, look what happened in Germany. It could have went either way during in the 20s. It could have went socialist or communist. And it did actually for a while. And then it went straight up to the Third Reich.
Yep. Exactly.
There's a historical process. It could have went either way.
Yep. There's moments where there's possibilities, and if they're not taken advantage of. Like, for example, we were talking off air about Venezuela being messed up right now and Trump wanting to intervene in there, do something or make it worse, which he's already done, which they've already done. And, we talked about, is Maduro really a socialist or not? I don't know. I don't think so, but neither was Chavez really. And yet there were moments in the Chavez administration where if he had become a socialist, right, or he had allowed his advisors or other people that were socialists to really go and nationalize the entire economy under democratic workers' control and so on, and try to spread the revolution around Latin America. Remember there was all those elections around the time of these progressives and so-called socialists, some of whom are still in power? That would have been really the way to go. And that's what we put forward in our material, for example. Didn't happen. Chavez gets sick and dies. Maduro continues the same.
I think he got killed, but that's
Yeah. And Maduro continues the same half measures that Chavez did. You know, it's like the Sandinistas. They got in Nicaragua in 1979. They actually won a guerrilla war to win power in a small country called Nicaragua in Central America, and part of movements that were happening around the time, guerrilla movements. Unfortunately, they did two things. They set up a guerrilla structure in power, which is the problem of guerrilla movements. They didn't set up workers' democracy. But secondly, they kept, what was it, 40, it might even be 60% of the economy in private hands. Oh. That's just waiting for the bourgeois to come back in power, because they have the money and they're going to influence the political system. So that also weakened the revolution to the point where Reagan got heavily involved in trying to destabilize them and did.
Contras.
Yeah. So anyway, back to the National Review. We're going to have to wind this up. We've got to get some other stuff. The guy mentions Bernie Sanders, et cetera. Then he says, still, if a socialist revolution is on the rise, Shama Sawant, Ginger Jensen, who's running for, he mentions her running for Minneapolis, he says won a large percentage of the vote. That's honest. I should have quoted that. In the November general election, a second member of the party, Ginger Jensen, won a large percentage of the vote in a race for city council seat in Minneapolis. This is true. Quote, it wasn't an aberration, the party cried in its monthly newsletter. Well, we don't have a newsletter. We have a newspaper. What's a newsletter? That's something you get this little folded thing or something. We have a newspaper.
It's a couple pages at the most.
Exactly.
We got at least, how many pages newsletter. Here? Like 8 to 9?
Yeah,
10?
We got a newspaper, buddy. Okay, so, yeah. So we shouldn't be trusted as bellwethers of socialism, meaning predictors of socialism. Why? Because we don't understand what socialism is. So we have a program on our monthly newspaper. Now he calls it a newspaper. And there's contradictions in it. Because at one point we call $50 minimum wage as a step towards living wage. But then he says socialism doesn't promise living wage for all so much as the abolition of wages entirely. Now, think about this for a second. This is what we mean by a conservative attacking us from an ultra-left position. Yes, everyone from Marx and other socialists to the present day will say the goal of socialism, ultimately, is a classless society where you don't need money and there'd be no wage slavery. There'd be no exploitation of people's labor through wage slavery. This is true, but the point is, right, do you start with that slogan? Do you say that's about to happen? Do you say that's the only thing we stand for? The fact is that socialists stand for anything that will improve the living conditions of the working class. So yes, we often support reforms, even though we know they're temporary under capitalism and it could be under attack. We support reforms as a way forward to make people have a better life, so people can have a better life, to also take the victories and build on them. So if a working class party or organization is getting some victories, and you can start to build on those victories, and it gives workers confidence to struggle for more. It's like if you say to workers, wait until we have, like by magic somehow, wait until we have no wages. It just sounds like abstract religiosity. It doesn't even mean anything. Well, how do you get to no wages? Oh, well, we fight. And then if you get into the idea of how we fight for that, that's going to include fighting for reforms, fighting for steps towards that.
Fighting for rights for housing. Fighting for rights for, you know, food, clothing on your back.
Absolutely.
Education, health care.
This guy's a right winger.
All those things.
What do right wingers ultimately want? Well, they want the status quo, true, but they also want a deeper rule. Like of the bourgeois, of the super rich and the big corporations. They want no opposition. They want free exploitation of all nature and labor that they want. Does the right wing start off saying, we want to get to the point where the Democratic Party doesn't exist, where there's no left wing beyond that Democratic Party to exist either? Are they honest about their racism? Do they want to get to the point where white supremacy or white domination internationally is the way it goes? No, they don't ever start with
their goals. We want this on a new third right in America.
Yeah, they don't get into their goals as a starting point. With us, the idea that we would not fight for a $50 minimum wage is crazy. Right, we would even think of not fighting for a demand that would a good demand, and you could argue on which demand is good at a time. Like right now, there's liberals that have been saying, while the $50 minimum wage movement has been growing, there's liberals that say, oh, that's too much. We disagreed with them. We fought for 15, and now they've come around. Most liberals that I know of, they support 15, or they say they support it.
I think even conservatives supported 15 at one point. Which is
conservative voters, definitely some, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, wow.
Yeah, another point advocates shortening the work week to share out the work with the unemployed and create new jobs. Yet just 4 bullet points earlier, the party demanded a minimum guaranteed income of $600 a week for the unemployed. Then he says, Marx would argue that social guarantees nobody is unemployed if executed properly. No kidding, but we're not in socialism yet. This guy is so crazy. He thinks that putting forward a demand somehow transports you magically into socialist land.
Yeah.
Well, socialism doesn't exist yet. But socialists are organizing for socialism. How do you do that? You put forward demands that people need. Again, back to the point of organizing. Things that people need, things that are a step towards socialism, point towards socialism. And Marx, of course, would not have argued some crazy. If you read the Communist Manifesto, there are demands in there that aren't, they don't equal the creation of socialism magically. in the next moment, but they're demands that they want realized immediately, as soon as possible, leading up to socialism, organizing towards socialism. So this person wants socialism to be like a utopian magic wish list of something that you just keep repeating over and over again, instead of what real politics is for anybody.
Read Engels, right, or whatever. What was it? Utopia and scientific socialism.
Yeah, social utopia and scientific.
Read that, and then come back to me.
Even the most utopian socialist movement, I can't think that
the Fabian.
A lot of them did
socialist.
Well, movement, they were more like liberals. But what I'm getting at is that I think that most of the utopian socialists that I can think of still try to do something. Like create a commune or something, you know what I mean? Like as crazy as dead end as that was. Yeah, yeah. So then he quotes Lenin, another example. So they said, wait a minute, so the unemployed don't receive a living wage under capitalism or socialism. No, we're for unemployed to receive a living wage under capitalism, actually. So he says that Marx wouldn't fight for unemployed benefits. He did. He fought for things like that. Then it says, again, quoting National Review, quoting Lenin, he who does not work shall not eat. Well, guess who that is directed at, National Review? That's directed at you type. People like the National Review types.
The bourgeoisie.
The bourgeois, the people that live off the work of others.
The bureaucracy, the autocracy.
Then he says we don't talk about workers seizing the means of production, a central tenet of true socialism. Well, actually, we do. We talk about occupations. We have definitely talked about that. We've talked about, like, when Sharma first got elected, there was almost a strike at Boeing. And she put forward, hey, if Boeing bosses say they are so contemptuous about what we need, then we don't need them. There's a lot of discussion in socialism about if he went down to the rest of our... Like, he says he's looking at this program we have in our paper, public ownership of the top 500 corporations that's in there. That's the same thing as seizing the means of production. So the guy doesn't even read carefully what he's talking about. So then he calls us progressive with socialist trappings because he can't imagine a socialism that that has actually an organizing component to it, or a socialism that has actually a component of what we would call transitional demands. I've seen other people call them transformative demands, but demands that help build the base for socialism. Blah, blah, blah. So then he says that... that socialism, he calls rigid, narrow. So this would be like, say, a society that wants full equality is somehow rigid and narrow and whatever. I don't see where that comes from. But he's basically saying that, we have to, like, pretend to be progressives in order to get anyone's ear. And that's not actually true. But you have to have a way forward. Like, if someone says, yeah, that sounds good to me, this is the goals of socialism, equality, and so on, next question is, well, how do we get there? What is to be done, as Lenin said? Well, that's what we get into, and that includes organizing for things and organizing for demands. Again, he doesn't mention the more far-reaching demands we do talk about. Let's see. And it's a very short article as well. Then he goes into, like, well, Sawant got elected, but look at Seattle, right? And you know, Seattle's one of the most busy, friendly cities, and she's the only socialist. It's dominated by Democrats. So this guy wants to go after the Democrats. He doesn't want to, but if he did, well, that would make a little sense. Although he probably wouldn't understand why they are the way they are. Then he says that Amazon, Microsoft, other mega corporations have changed Seattle to for the better, you know, which in reality he doesn't say that people struggled very, very hard for $50 minimum wage and other things that we've won, housing and so on in Seattle. Drop Sawant or Jensen to another U.S. city, and they would have done as well. Now, this is really weird, because first he does this whole thing about Seattle is unique, which is a common thing about us winning. You know, like, only in Seattle. Well, we almost won in Minneapolis. And in fact, we ran a candidate 3 years ago, in 2013 in Minneapolis, Ty Moore, who came within 200 votes of winning in Ward 9 in Minneapolis. So he says, oh, you drop him to another city, he wouldn't do as well. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see about that. Strategic timidity. The strategy is about the demands. So just by having demands that sound completely utopian and repeating those over and over and over again, this would be strategic militancy, apparently, by this from this guy's point of view. But the opposite would be true. It would be the easiest thing to counteract. It would be simple to just repeat the same goals over and over again without talking about how to get there. He doesn't like the fact that we use the word democratic or alternative because socialism can't be that, of course, when in reality the Russian Revolution was the most democratic revolution ever. Let's see. And here we go. This electoral compromise can, in a sense, be viewed as a victory for capitalism. So until you have socialism, anybody winning anything under capitalism is reinforcing the system. Now, this is a very ultra-left argument. This guy is a conservative making extremely ultra-left argument. In other words, like there's some group, some political philosophy, like elements of Maoism that basically say, for example, hey, any countries with a certain level of development, you can't have a revolution there because the workers are bought off. Not understanding that it's relative levels of development, losing, going downward, not necessarily all at once, especially not all at once, but that's what really makes people
So you're saying that a place like Russia 100 years ago was ripe for revolution for why?
Me? What would I say?
Yeah.
Oh, well, actually, the conditions were really bad for most workers there.
So it has to be that bad for a country to say, yeah, we're having a socialist revolution.
No, actually, what I was getting at was something like Maoist would say that any development of the working class in terms of unions, political parties, or a country that's industrialized, they're all bought off. They won't have a revolution. Only the poorest countries in the world will. And that's really not true, because the poorest countries in the world mm-hmm. often don't have revolutions. Even China, you know, Maoism coming from Stalinism, had a certain level of development compared to a lot of countries. Russia certainly did as well. It was one of the weaker capitalist countries, but it was still relatively developed compared to three quarters of the world at the time. And also there have been revolutionary movements in advanced capitalist countries like France 68, Germany 1917-23, Hungarian Revolution 1919, and others that came, some succeeded for a short time, Spanish Revolution. So no, I'm actually arguing the opposite. It's relative standards. See, remember Trotsky said, and others, capitalism developed through combined and uneven development. So what you had is the initial capitalist powers going out and conquering the rest of the world for their own capitalist system, for capitalism, basically. And they didn't invite everyone else in as equal partners. They exploited them, exploited cheap labor, exploited cheap resources, tried to establish colonies, trade routes, and so on. This led to all the bourgeois wars and all the wars under capitalism. And if you ever in a country that, even though it might be an imperialist country, if living standards are falling, that can create a revolutionary situation as much as in a country that starts in a lower area and living standards are falling in those countries as well. If the swaths and jets of the world hope for a real social revolution in America, they have a lot of convincing to do and a lot more, and a lot of marks to read yet still. Which is really hilarious.
This guy,
all you have to do is Xerox the page from, or scan in the page from the Communist Manifesto that has the demands at the end. And then he would have to say Marx is not a Marxist, socialism is not socialism. Not that everything is derivative of Marx, but a lot of it is codified or systematized initially, a lot of the basic methods and ideas by some of that writing. And so, right, you could prove right from the start the idea of putting forward demands that are not goals in and of themselves. I'm sorry, demands that are not full-blown socialist society practices. You know, is there? So, did you follow the Alabama election? The right wing more guy that was
it.
All over
I
the place in the
it.
Media, right? Yeah. Okay. So. I came across a good article. We've quoted this guy on, talked about this guy before, this author, on this show on Social Alternative Radio. Paul Streedy writes a lot for Counterpunch. You know that website, mm-hmm. counterpunch.org. And so he's got what's not happening with Mr. Jones. Jones is the Democrat that won. And he goes over the election. I don't have time to go through the whole thing, but he starts off showing how horrible, absolutely horrible, Moore was. But, you know, the whole thing about even before the stuff about pedophilia and going after young girls, this guy was the guy that tried to bring the Ten Commandments into the lobby of the Alabama Judicial Building and refused to move them when a federal court said so. He's the guy that said that 9/11 was divine punishment for America's blasphemous toleration of homosexuality and women's right to choose.
9/11?
Yeah. It was divine retribution. This is the same guy that said, and
it's not because of imperialism, you know, and, uh-huh. and what it spews, and, you know, like Malcolm said, the roots has come home.
Well, here's the real one that he should have been known for. He basically said, this is a real quote. I got this even before I saw this article. I got this quote on Facebook. Despite his history, quote, as a sexual predator is horrific and richly worthy of combination disgust, this statement that this guy made was often neglected. When Moore said in response to a black citizen who asked Moore when he thought America had been great in the past, because Moore is like one of these make America great again people, Moore said, I think it was great at a time when families were united, even though we had slavery. Get what this means. They cared already for one another. Our families were strong. The country had direction. Then, of course, the answer, and I'm not going to quote, but the answer is, what? That means that whose families were strong? Well, I am quoting now. Whose families were strong in the South under the slave system? You know what I mean? He's talking about murder, lynchings, torture, breaking up of families to make people property, and families were strong. This guy's a nut job, and that's what goes to the point I was saying earlier. Moore, the Republican candidate, the fact that he could even get on a ballot and get serious support shows that lesser evilism has created a space for right-wing nut jobs like this. You know,
power vacuum.
That wouldn't get, yeah, because people don't see any alternative. They just see, you know, like a lot of people still stayed home in this election. I don't know if Street goes into that, but the turnout was still really low. Now, the reason is you could have decades, even a century of, like in the South, where you had the Democrats, the Jim Crow Democrats in power for a long time, right, since the end of Reconstruction, right, to the Republicans start to move in the last 20 years. Now, for the average Southern working person during that time, what's improved? Now, for black workers, the Civil Rights Movement improved a lot. But these guys, more, Jones actually did a case against the black church murders in the South. But these guys don't represent a new Civil Rights Movement or anything, right? So the point is that people are not voting for a reason. And we don't like that. We want people to vote, right? Social Alternative, we want people to vote, get used to voting. Because we want to see, under socialism, where you have real democracy, you'd have to be voting on a lot of things. You'd be expressing your opinion about a lot of things. You know, about economic things that right now are totally shut off from us. So anyway, he's basically saying this is a very low bar that was set to have this, like, extreme right-wing Republican. And then you have this guy Moore, I'm sorry, this guy Jones with the Democratic Party run and almost not win, which is ridiculous in itself. And a lot of people are making that equation, I find, on Facebook. They're kind of saying, they're seeing that Trump do these horrible things. They're seeing the Democratic Party not being able to stop it. So they're questioning from that angle their affiliation to the Democratic Party as a voter. I find that really interesting. And I you know, because I think you could find plenty to not like about the Democratic Party without going there, without saying, well, they're just not the best defense against the Republicans, you know? Like, what is going to be the offense against the Republicans, you know? That sort of thing. And yet people are basically saying, hey, they can't even stop this. What's going on, you know? So I think that's an interesting way to look at it. So anyway, he goes on to that. Did you see this article by any chance that I'm talking about? This one right here? Okay. He goes on to talk more about the election and how bad Moore was. But then he gets into what Jones was talking about. And Jones did this thing where He put out an ad, you're not going to believe this, with a Confederate soldier and a Northern soldier. So he puts about a Civil War era ad. But he uses it to say, well, basically, instead of being at odds, we will get together, you know? So his whole thing is bipartisanship and cooperating. So what that resulted in is after he got elected, Trump called him up. And so I heard a radio interview with this guy.
I heard that on TV.
Well, I heard it on NPR. And this guy said,
Something that Trump said, I think we can work with this guy. I'm like, I'm looking at this like.
Yeah. Yep. And then
that's what I heard.
What he said.
I think we can work with this guy.
Phone call. I don't know, because this guy, Jones, said, I got a nice call from the president, and I would want to go up there as soon as I can to meet with him. And he talks about going across the aisle, so to speak, and bipartisanship is a big thing. And then he had the night that he won. Let's quote this: "How telling it was to see Jones and his backers chanting USA, USA, as they celebrated their victory over one-legged Bible thumping super freak." That's Street's article. World citizens beware. Expect superpower to be reinvigorated with another Democratic Party-led rebranding over the next 3 years. Totally agree with that. That you have, whether it's Sanders or whoever, affiliated to or in the Democratic Party, you look at them, they're really voting with Trump, a lot of them, on foreign policy stuff, you know? And they're really, their record of voting is pro-imperialist. He ends the article quoting Chris Hedges and also Howard Zinn, where he kind of like is bending the stick, this guy, this off the street, is bending the stick against electoral politics a little too much, in my opinion. But still, there's some good things in here. He's quoting Hedges. In the summer of 2016, Hedges said, "The predatory financial institutions on Wall Street will trash the economy and loot the U.S. Treasury on the way to another economic collapse, whether Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton is president." This was written before the election. Money will replace the vote, whether Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton is president, and half the country which now lives in poverty will remain in misery, whether Trump or Clinton is because president. This is not speculation. We know it's because there's been total continuity on every issue, from trade agreements to war to mass deportation between the Bush administration and the Barack Obama administration. The problem is not Donald Trump. The problem is capitalism. This is Chris Hedges again. And this is the beast we are called to fight and slay. Until that is done, nothing of substance will change. To reduce the political debate, as Bernie Sanders and others are doing, to political personalities is political infantilism. We have undergone a corporate coup. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton will not reverse this coup. They, like Barack Obama, know where the centers of power lie. They serve these centers of power. And then he ends up with a quote from Zinn, where before Zinn had died, he saw the 2008 election unfolding. He said, "Historically, government, within the hands of Republicans or Democrats, conservative or liberals, has failed its responsibilities until forced to, by direct action, sit-ins and freedom rides for the rights of black people, strikes and boycotts for the rights of workers, mutinies and desertions for soldiers in order to stop a war. Voting is easy and marginally useful, but it is a poor substitute for democracy, which requires direct action by concerned citizens." I like some of that, but actually, voting is much, running electoral campaigns is much more useful than Zinn lets on there, possibly because he never was that involved in them, as far as I know. So, starting to run out of time, we got this Trump tax plan, Robin Hood in reverse. Now, this has been changing a little bit. Have you been following this in the media at all?
Yeah.
They've changed a little bit. Like, for example, grad students that I knew were very upset that Trump was going to do, include grad student, tuition reimbursement and stuff as income. And this was going to be really horrible. I think that's off the table for now. And they increase.
What, if you owed your.
They were going to charge everything. Yeah.
If you owed a federal loan or whatever it is, student loan, whatever you won't get your income tax. So just go right to that principal?
I think it was a little different. No. It was like right now, you're a grad student and they give you tuition free in exchange you teach and like that. This would all be taxable income, and before it wasn't. So your taxes would shoot way up. And a lot of people couldn't afford that. But not that many people are grad students, but you know, that's just one example. This is an article by Teddy Shibabao.
Yeah, we had him here once.
Yep, from Socialist Alternative. Shibabao, yep. He's from Ethiopia originally. And blah, blah, blah. Let's see. Tax reform is class welfare. The tax plan is also billed as tax reform, a simplification of the tax code, a long time talking point of the conservative tax policy. It involves collapsing the personal income tax brackets into just four levels from seven. Now, again, I don't know. This was written in late November. I'm not sure what still exists as far as some of the details. But it's actually raising taxes on the poor or reducing taxes on the rich is the bottom line here. Because you're reducing the top tax rate from 39 to 35%. It also, it's not even counting the cuts to vital social services that will happen when the funding is cut because of the tax cuts. And we're at a time when U.S. corporate profits are at a historic high. CNBC reported May 12th this year that about, quote, 72% of the S&P 500 firms, as the top corporations, have topped Wall Street estimates in their profit earnings. Moreover, some 20 top U.S. corporations, companies, made $3.2 trillion in total revenue in 2016 and only paid $108 billion in federal taxes, just a little over 3%. That's from Forbes. So why do they need to pay less than 3%? 3% is already nothing. How about taxing the rich? The article goes into the grand justification for all this, of course, is tired out trickle-down economics. That's what we got into earlier about how there's nothing that says to a corporation, if you save money from some cost cut, like you screwed over the workers more, you're paying less in taxes, got something cheaper, some machinery or some good that you put in your process or whatever, then does that mean that money has to go to raises for the workers? No. Does it mean money has to go be reinvested to create jobs? No, so-called create jobs. The corporate people they're interviewing on this are saying openly that money's going to go to paying shareholders higher profits, higher dividends, going to mergers and acquisitions, taking over the corporations. And what was the third one? Oh, yeah, well, basically giving them bigger salaries. They didn't actually mention that, but I'm going to throw that one in there. Fact is that corporate profits are historic highs and the income of the top 1%, especially the top 0.1%, has risen to stratospheric levels, has the United States paying among the lowest effective tax rates in the world. So in other words, they go out and say it's 35% the tax rate. It's actually 34 point something, but the amount that's collected in taxes keeps dropping. So that's what they call the effective tax rate. The latest figure I read was 14%. I'm not sure he puts that in here. So it's a really good article, though. And it ends up saying any party worth its salt as a defender of the 99% would be fighting loud and clear for these for demands like tax, increased tax on the super rich, the banks, and the Fortune 500 companies. We've spent years bailing them out for no real return on investment. Remember under Obama, bailed out all these big banks and corporations. The role of the Democratic Party has revealed earlier in budget discussions, which saw a $695.5 billion defense bill supported by 60% of House Democrats and all but four Democratic senators. That's from Forbes. This defense spending is in excess of what Trump himself proposed. Meanwhile, The Intercept reports that the money spent on this plan alone could fund free public college. While taxing the rich is a first step, it's not enough. As long as the wealth is controlled by the top 1% of the capitalist class, they will find ways to hoard as much of their wealth as possible, and their system will be a source of economic and social crises. We need to fight a socialist society in which the top banks and corporations are taken into... Oh, here's that guy saying we didn't talk about this. Remember? We don't talk about seizing the means of production. Well, this is what that is. We need to fight for a social society which the top banks and corporations take into public ownership under democratic control of workers, consumers, and the broader public. Only then can we guarantee that these massive profits currently shielded from the treasuries of the capitalist governments are used for full public investment in jobs and social services. So check that out in the latest, the November edition of Socialist Alternatives newspaper. Do you want to talk about the Tariq Ali book? We got 15 minutes or 10-something minutes.
Yeah, so this is his book. It's called The Dilemma of Lenin by Tariq Ali. Subtitled Terrorism, War, Empire, and Love Revolution. So I'll just read the summary here. Without Lenin, there would have been no socialist revolution in 1917. Of this much, we can be certain. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. He's saying in 1917?
Without Lenin, there would have been no socialist revolution in 1917.
Yeah, but you got to be careful with that. Mm-hmm. You got to be careful with that because, Lenin provided a key role of leadership at a certain time. If Lenin hadn't been there or something, there would have been a socialist revolution in Russia, I believe. Maybe not at that time.
Because he's putting it on one, all on one shoulder, one person.
Well, yeah.
And it's broader than that.
Yeah, it's broader than that. But also the timing was important. And individuals can play a key role. But I think the conditions were there. Like they had a revolution in 1905, right?
Yeah.
1917, they have another one. It's actually two-parter. I think there would have been a revolution without Lenin. But the question is, when would that have been? Would have been a different timing, I think.
And what
I think it would have been socialist because the movement was strong. Like you said, the Soviets were strong, the workers' councils.
All right, so he starts with Lenin, leader of the October 1917 uprising, is one of the most misunderstood leaders of the 20th century. In his own time, there were many, even among his enemies, who acknowledged a full magnitude of his intellectual and political achievements. But his legacy has been lost in misinterpretation. He is worshipped but rarely read. On the centenarium of the Russian Revolution, Tariq Ali explores the two major influences of Lenin's thought, the turbulent history of Tsarist Russia and the birth of the international labor movement, and explains how Lenin confronting dilemmas that still cast a shadow over the present. Is terrorism ever a viable strategy? Is support for imperial wars ever justified? Can politics be made without a party? Was the seizure of power in 1917 morally justified? Should he have parted company from his wife and lived with his lover? In The Dilemmas of Lenin, Ali... In The Dilemmas of Lenin, Ali provides an insightful portrait of Lenin's deepest preoccupations and underlines the clarity and vigor of his theoretical and political formulations. He concludes with an affecting account of Lenin's last 2 years when he realized that we knew nothing and insisted that the revolution had to be renewed lest it withered and died. Here's a quote from Wednesday. Yep. We talk about his enemies.
Yep.
Here's a quote of Winston Churchill on Lenin, which was a favorable quote, which is weird because he was, Churchill was a ruthless anti-communist,
Oh yeah, Churchill was a horrible genocidal.
Here's quoting. I'm quoting Churchill on Lenin. He was at the age to feel. His mind was a remarkable instrument. When its lights shone, it revealed the whole world, its history, its sorrows, its stupidities, its shams, and above all, its wrongs. It revealed all facts in focus. The most unwelcome, the most inspiring, with an equal ray, the intellect was capacious and in some faces superb. It was capable of universal comprehension in a degree rarely reached among men. The execution of the elder brother, talk about his elder brother, this broad white light through a prism, and the prism was red. Bye.
I think that Ali is sort of this... As far as I know, he's not in an organization. He was for a short time.
He's a writer.
When he was really younger. Yeah, he was in the Fourth International, I think. you know, under Mandela and all that for a short time in Britain. But I don't know. I think he plays to what he, his audience, or what he imagines as his audience from time to time, which would be the liberal intellectuals. I think he's a leftist. I mean, I like reading a lot of his stuff. But it reminds me also of like this book I was talking about on air by, called October by China Mieville that just came out about the October Revolution. You know, they both, I like to see what you think at the end of it when you get through it, because they both, at least Mieville, actually, you know, doesn't, you know, he repeated some of the slanders against Lenin that aren't true. You know, I think because he felt like he had to throw that in towards the end or something. There's a lot of pressure on, if you want to get your work published or something, that you're not, or you're not a real socialist, you know, that you're not really out there organizing in the trenches for it. They don't like that, the publishing companies, obviously. But, and, you know, Lenin, you know, nobody's perfect, but he gave a lot of, some of the things he did, like when he came back, like this whole question of would the revolution have happened without Lenin refers often to the fact that he came back from exile in April of 1917, which is between the two revolutions, and there was a section of the Bolshevik Party leadership, especially, probably reflected in some members as well, that were kind of getting used to the government of Kerensky and kind of adapting to it, which was a horrible thing to do from the Bolshevik standpoint, from the socialist standpoint, because that meant that World War One was still continuing, and that was okay, which it wasn't. It was horrible. It was a meat grinder killing thousands and thousands of Russians.
They lost
Russians.
The most.
And they it meant that the government was refusing to do land reform, so you're okay with that. It's a pro. The government is still allowing capitalism to continue. February Revolution didn't get rid of capitalism. The 1917 Revolution did, you know? So Lenin comes back with, and it's this famous speech called the April Thesis or April Theses or whatever, where he basically says, very briefly, but says it clearly, we should not be giving a support to the provisional government. We should not be giving a support to the constituent assembly idea anymore. The Soviets are now real. They're huge. They're workers' councils. They're direct democracy. And what you have in power is still elements of bourgeois democracy, despite Kerensky being called a socialist, kind of a Bernie Sanders figure.
Was he a Menshevik?
No, not even that. No. He was just a, I don't know, just a, I mean, he would be, had be like a Menshevik, but I don't think he was one. I think he was basically, and then he wasn't in that organization. He was basically just a quote-unquote socialist in some form, I guess, very extremely reformist form. And but he's the point is that the administration under Kerensky is carrying out all these old policies that were horrible for the Russian working class that resulted in the February Revolution. You know what I mean? Continuing the war, not doing land reform, except, you know, capitalism just running roughshod over everything. But also that got even worse, if you want to call it that, by you know, the regime cementing itself. Still having, being, you know, just because Kerensky was a nominal socialist doesn't mean everyone else was. They weren't. So you had this capitalist regime essentially still in power, even with a so-called, even though it came after revolution and had a so-called socialist at the head of it. So the basic grind of exploitation, the war, and all that continued. And they, you know, Lenin came in and said, well, what were our original demands? These are still extremely important. Bread, peace, land. And he added to that all power to the Soviets, you know, so very basic stuff. So bread, no land reform, peace, the war grinding on, I'm sorry, bread, malnutrition and hunger in society, despite the wealth the capitalists and the old czarist regime has at that time. Peace, you know, get rid of the war, don't do the war, withdraw from the war. Land,
housing.
Land reform, yeah. And then, and all power to the Soviets. And why are we drifting from this? And the regime was getting so right-wing, in fact. I mean, what might not have been clear in April, I'm not sure. I'd have to reread some stuff. But just because something is called democratic doesn't mean it is. So by July of that year, the Kerensky regime is trying to use fascists to shut down the opposition, including the Bolsheviks. So they give power to this General Kornilov to provoke a lot of battles and repression, hoping that there'll be a counter attack that they can exploit to further do further repression and basically just create like a fascist dictatorship, or if that's not what they had in mind per se, create a very much military strongman type thing, still under the control of the provisional government, but more more to what they felt they needed at the time to keep down